Welcome to the class tonight, and we're going to be dealing with Mark again. How many years is it, James? You've been on Mark before, five, would it?
Probably 15.
Truly, is it that long? Well, that is an epistle, isn't it? So anyhow, we're up to chapter 15, so it must be getting close towards the end. So we look forward to tonight. Yeah. We're going to read from Mark 15, and we're going to read from 6 to 23. Okay, so we're going to call James forward now, and he's titled his talk 8 a.m, so that'll be interesting. Thanks, James.
Well, hello. Welcome. Thanks for coming tonight. So it's been a couple of years since we last looked at Mark, and what the plan is to revisit a little section to deal with the other Jesus. And we'll start off by looking at Golgotha, the sort of geography, and then we'll look at Golgotha in the spiritual context, which it's probably more meaningful than us than exactly where it is. And if we've got time, we'll have a revisit of Simon the Cyrenian and then a little bit of thinky time on maybe just how Jesus managed to get through all of this. I'll tease you with 6 points, and in the following fortnight, God willing, I think, Sam, you're on next week. Is that right, Lazarus?
Yes.
Good. Good. Is it?
Yeah.
Good. And then you've got another four after that. So then we'll look at some of the steps that help us, that obviously helped Jesus. Okay, all good? So the time check is, it's about 8 a.m. in the morning. We're reminded that we've got Simon the Cyrenian, who's coming from Africa, and he's carrying the cross behind Jesus as Jesus is staggering towards this place called Golgotha. Now, when we have a look at those two images, they might be familiar to some of us that have got familiarity with pop culture in the 70s and 80s. That's actually Skull Cave, right? So who lived in Skull Cave? Zoe, the Phantom, the man who cannot die. But interestingly, it was the 21st Phantom that told us that the first Phantom built Skull Cave and the Skull Throne in 1936. You keeping up there? What I'm really interested in, though, is in the movie in 1996, that's sort of the blurry image of Skull Cave, right? Now, when we look at that, sort of the makeup of that, the set designer says, okay, well, we need to make it look like a skull. So the sort of yawning mouth is a pretty easy entry. We've got a couple of windows there that represent the third story. The gym was built in 1980, the radio room in 1970, and then you've got the nose. Who knows what happens in the nose? Only the nose knows. Okay, so James, big deal. I just want you to pay attention, though, to sort of the more real-life image. As I mentioned, our salvation does not depend on knowing the precise location of where Golgotha was. But our salvation does depend on believing that the events which took place in Golgotha really happen. So then, so Golgotha is an Aramaic or a Hebrew word, and we read tonight that it's known as the place of the skull. So if we go back to Greek first, and then we'll head to a little Latin lesson. The Greek word is cranion, cranion. So where is it? Huey, have a look at Matthew 27, verse 39 for me. Dougsy, can you please look at John chapter 19, verse 20? Maxi, Psalm 69, verse 12. So we've got Hugh, Matthew 27, 39, Dougs, John 19, 20, and Maxi, Psalm 69, verse 12. Read on, Lonsdale. Oh, you haven't got your Lonsdale top on tonight.
No. And they that passed by reviled him, wagging their heads.
That's good. So the point there is they that passed by. John 19, Dukes.
Then many of the Jews read this title in the place where Jesus was crucified, was near the city, and it was written in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin.
Okay, so again, there's another little clue. It's near the city. It's a place where people are walking to and fro. So it sounds it's a bit like a road close to town. Now, of course, when you're dealing with a castle, castel, to get into the city, you normally went through a what?
Okay.
Right. Max.
Psalm 69, verse 12.
Yes, please.
They that sit in the gate speak against me, and I was the song of the drunkards.
So Psalm 69 is a messianic psalm. And what it's saying is that as Jesus has sort of passed, the people that sat in the gate, which were a certain type of people, mainly judges, elders, seniors, people that were making decisions on behalf of the city, were drunk and having a crack at Jesus. Pretty bad, because we know that Jesus is crucified at 9 a.m. And so we're taking a punt that as he exits the city, it's 8 a.m. So remember, Jesus has been up all night and up all of the previous night. Now, in Latin, the word Golgotha translates to Calvaria. Now, we sung that in hymn number 222, where we sung the Hill of Calvary. We also sing that same line, Hill of Calvary, in hymn number 358, ironically also in the third verse. Okay, so when the Bible is translated into Latin in the 10th century, so from it goes from Hebrew, Greek, Latin, English, so as early as the 10th century, what they did, the translators, is they used the Latin word, so that's why we call it Calvary, and that became commonplace amongst Christianity. To the Hill of Calvary I'll go. The hill. Does the Bible give any reference at all to Golgotha being on a hill? Well, I don't know if it does, but I reckon we might have a little clue. So there could be some reasons why it's called a hill. One historian purports that this is the place where criminals were executed, political prisoners, and basically it was just a pile of bodies, one on top of the other, so it became a hill. Now, I can sort of see the sense of that, except that doesn't sound very Jewish, right? Because the Jews didn't just leave people out in the open. So I'm not sure about that. The site currently which the Catholics believe was Golgotha was discovered and located in the year 325 AD by Emperor Constantine's mother. Currently, that is a church, and it's known as Ted, the Church of the Holy... Yeah. So, it's believed that that's the place where Jesus was crucified, just outside of the wall, and slightly north was his new tomb. Now, there's a little bit of a trick. So the image up the top is the image taken from the Phantom movie. Oh, sorry, I made a mistake. No, that's Jerusalem. Now, it looks pretty similar to the image in the Phantom movie, doesn't it? Yeah, and it does actually look like a skull. You can see the two eyes there quite clearly, the nose, the mouth. And I'm sure that if anyone has been to Jerusalem, you've probably got on the bus and had a tour. So when you have a look at the actual geography, yeah, that's it does look about right. But let's get this idea of hill sorted. So the Greek translation, we've got Golgotha in Hebrew, the Greek translation is the word skull, Greek is cranium. Now, the part of our head that is a cranium is this, right? That bit. It's the bit that holds our very large brains, Huey. Yeah, no, that's completely different. So when you have a look at the Lion's Gate, so you can see that there is a little hillock, right? And it sort of does look like, you know, look like my cranium, maybe Ted's. Maybe not so much the hirsute young men in the front row. So the point of all this. Oh, one final observation about this particular location. So just remember that The instant, the very instant that Jesus dies, the veil of the temple is ripped in half. We understand that the temple faced east, and if it faced east and that gate was open and you're standing on a hill, the Lion's Gate in particular, you could actually theoretically see. Now, remember that these walls got destroyed in AD 70, but this is the theory. Now, why is that theory important? Because someone had to witness the exact moment that Jesus died, because when that happened, at the exact moment, that's when the veil was rent. And the veil was huge. It's sort of much bigger than this wall and higher. Ripped in two like a piece of tissue paper. So my point really there is there must have been eyewitnesses. Okay. Now, the place itself must have been important. Why? Because the place is mentioned in all four Gospels. But it's mentioned in a particular way in Matthew, which made me give some consideration to the idea that it's the spiritual aspect of this place that is more important than the physical location. So remember, Mark is the first gospel. It's the shortest. It's the most concise. Matthew was written to the Jews. So why does Matthew, writing to the Jews, say this? Well, the place is called Golgotha, and that is to say the place of the skull. Now, every Jew would have known that. So why does he add that extra little bit? If I'm writing to someone that's not familiar with the geography of Jerusalem, like someone that's, who lives in Asia Minor, I'd include that, right? That might be important, but not for Jews. So I think that there's four possibilities, four spiritual sort of sides of this. Now, if I was to ask you just to reflect upon the name of a person in the Old Testament that sounds a bit like the Hebrew word Gol-Oleth, any takers? Yes, well, I think we're all thinking in our heads, Melchizedek. Right, good on you, Sebastian. I'm glad you're with me. Okay, let's try Goliath, all right? That would have been our second guess. Goliath. So David knocks off his head, takes his sword, pops it in Ahithophel's place, who lived at Nob, which is about 200 metres north of the walls of Jerusalem, apparently. So we know that David goes there in the 1st of Samuel, chapter 21 and verse 9. Now, I'm a Jew. I'm being told to remember the significance of the place of the skull. So let's just put a spiritual layer about the story of David and think about how it resonates with what Jesus actually achieved. So the story goes a bit like this. After some amazing achievements against those who ravaged the flock, he, that is David, despised by his brethren, coming from Bethlehem at his father's command, left the sheep in order to fight the great enemy alone. We sang about that tonight. He put aside all human help and with the first, Genesis 3:15, of five stones, bruised the adversary right in the head. That success rallied the Lord's people behind him. Now they added their onslaught and victory. Whose son is this? They asked. Jesse's name means God exists. And the prize for his victory was the king's daughter, Psalm 45, verse 14. Whose son is this? Oh, we can't tell who his dad is. The name Jesse means God exists. Jesus' prize for his victory was the ecclesia, his bride. Another possibility about while we're thinking about Golgotha is because of the root word of this Golgoleth, which is Gilgal. Gilgal. What happened at Gilgal? Well, Gilgal was the place that we read about in Joshua chapter 5, where the rolling away of the reproach of Egypt occurred. Now, of course, when we think about Egypt, it's another redemption story, isn't it? A people were redeemed out of bondage. They were baptized in the cloud and the sea. But there was one particular activity that rolled away the reproach at Gilgal. And Paul writes about that in Colossians chapter 2. The activity was circumcision. Colossians 2. In whom also ye are circumcised with the circumcision made without hands, in putting off the body of the sins of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ, buried with him in baptism, wherein also ye are risen with him through the faith of the operation of God, who hath raised him from the dead. So the idea here is, Jewish mind, go back to what the word means and the root word and what happened there. Well, it was the place where we were baptized. It was the place where we said no to the flesh and yes to God. Or at least that was the theory. Now, there are two interesting ideas that come from Hosea chapter 10 and Hosea chapter 9. So Hosea chapter 9 is a really lengthy prophecy about what happens to Jesus that's recorded in Luke. I'll just pick it up, say, at verse 15. I won't. I have to read verse 8. I've got a reason for reading verse 8, which some of you might already be aware of. And they shall say to the mountains, cover us, and to the hills, fall on us. That's mentioned in Luke 23. O Israel, thou hast sinned from the days of Gibeah. The Hebrew word for Gibeah is actually Gabbatha. Gabbatha is the place where Pilate sat at judgment against Jesus in John 9. In Hosea chapter 9, verse 15, it says this, all their wickedness is in Golgotha, for there I hated them. For the wickedness of all their doings, I will drive them out of mine house. I will love them no more. All their princes are revolters and revolting. Now, of course, root words can be many different things. And another one to make note of is Ezekiel chapter 10. Galgal, which is the words to describe the wheels inside the cherubim chariot. You know, the eyes within eyes and they're turning, representing Jesus. So let's put some of this together. Moments later, after we're told about where Jesus was going, and it would have been a spot that was regularly used for crucifixions, there more than likely was three holes already dug, probably already been used for other crucifixions just like it. We might need to read Luke chapter 23, verse, let's say, 27 to 29, Catherine or Sam? 27. We'll start there. Verse 27, all of it, yes, please.
Okay. And there followed him a great company of people and of women, which also bewailed and lamented him.
Thank you. And how about, we might just go down to the end of the prophecy, which is at the end of verse 31. Yes, please.
But Jesus, turning unto them, said, daughters of Jerusalem, weep not for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For behold, the days are coming in which they shall say, blessed are the barren, and the wombs which they never bear, and the paps which never gave suck. Then shall they begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. For if they do these things in a green tree, what shall be done in the dry?
So this is a pretty macabre scene, really, isn't it? So you've got a crowd that's almost whipping up a bloodlust because, well, they're going to watch a crucifixion. So now we're going to go back to the Dark Ages in England, where if there was a public hanging to occur, it was turned into a carnival. The same thing happened during the French Revolution. You know, when Robespierre was going all around France, picking up the aristocrats, taking them Vive la France to Madame la Guillotine and lopping off their heads. Again, it was called a carnival. Carnival. Now, to understand the etymology, is that the word? I think so. Of that word, we need to go back to the Italian. Carne, of course, means meat or flesh. Velere means to follow. So it's like a following of the flesh. And what is it about human beings that turns a gruesome event like a beheading or a hanging or a crucifixion into some sort of celebration? It's not unique to Jews. All people do it. And it's really weird. In fact, if you watch the Scarlet Pimpernel movie with Anthony Andrews and Jane Seymour, it's almost like a celebration where days before, where there's going to be a guillotine set up, there's people setting up stalls, there's people baking bread, there's people selling oysters. It's a pickpocket's delight, you know, little kids pinching wallets. It was like an Adelaide show that actually went ahead. But this is our Lord we're talking about here, right? So what is it that intrigues human beings about the ghoulish spectacle of capital punishment? So there's women here. So the women are isolated out of this particular group of people that were following. Not all of the women, there were some women. Well, who were they? I'm fairly certain these women were not Jesus' disciples, but they were important enough for Jesus to stop in his tracks, where he could barely put one foot ahead of another, gather his thoughts, and then quote three or four sections from the Old Testament to explain to them that their plight was actually going to be far worse than his own. Now, I think that's pretty amazing. He says, "Don't wait for me." Well, out of their pure pity for the human race, those women did weep for Jesus. Weep for yourselves, weep for your children. Now, I think this says a lot to us about how the Lord Jesus Christ managed to get through these situations. So let's think back. He's praying for Pilate's wife. He preaches to Simon the Cyrenian. He is praying for the soldiers. He is praying for his mother. He's praying for his cousin John. He's praying for the two malefactors that were alongside of him. You see, Jesus' attention isn't on himself, but it's on everyone else, including these women. Well, we know what he said. See, Jesus understood these prophecies in Luke chapter 19. We know that he'd already wept over Jerusalem. He doesn't do that very often. And he wept because of the fate and the horror that would befall them. At his trial, remember the people said, "Well, let his blood be upon us and our children." Well, sometimes we've got to be careful what we wish for. Jonah prophesied that after that 3 days, there would be a 40-year period and Jerusalem would be overthrown on the day of Passover, the exact same day as Jesus is crucified. Why is Passover significant? Well, it's the time when all of Israel comes down to celebrate in Jerusalem to hold that feast together. So in AD 70, the city was brimming full of people. In verse 30 of Luke 23, we read, "Then shall they begin to say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.'" Where have we read that before, gents? Ladies? Close. Hosea, did you say?
Yeah.
You did. You got it right. Let's go. I have to go back a slide or two on your maxi. Okay. Verse 8 of Hosea chapter 10. "And they shall say to the mountains, 'Cover us,' and to the hills, 'Fall on us.'" The climax of human suffering, which was the experience of the generation that crucified the Lord Jesus and their children, guilty and innocent alike, all bore down heavily on Jesus. It bore down so heavily that he felt more sympathy for them than for his own shame and his own pain and his own misery. And we sort of think, well, when this event came, did anyone actually reflect on what Jesus said that day? When the Romans broke through the walls and the gates, we're told that many Jews hid in sewers, they hid in underground caves, and many prayed to be swallowed by an avalanche, just as Hosea said they would. In fact, it got so bad even before the Romans entered the city that many threw themselves fatally to the ground by jumping off the walls. So for us, we need to think about how possibly Jesus could summon up the strength to scour through the scriptures, to have his mind so focused that he could cherry pick these amazing Bible passages that were just so relevant. And maybe the lesson for us is, in our toughest times, in times of our greatest weakness, the things which are causing us the most distress and weighing us down, let's find the answers in the Bible just like Jesus did. Okay, so we read in Mark 15 verse 23 that Jesus is offered a drink, a narcotic of sour wine and gall myrrh. We're told, I think, in the Matthew record that it was gall. It wasn't a strong drug, but myrrh was precious, right? We know that. We know that myrrh was expensive. Why? Who was a giver of myrrh? Well, at Jesus' birth, a wise man gave Jesus' parents gold, myrrh, and frankincense. And we've argued before that the reason why they were given, the parents were given those gifts, was in part to help finance the raising of their family. So the Talmud actually answers the question about why these women were there. There existed in Jerusalem a society of charitable women who made themselves responsible for easing the suffering of these poor wretches who were condemned to crucifixion. Now, of itself, this is a very mild pain reliever. You sort of wonder, they did have opium back in these days, why they didn't use something stronger. Anyway, they didn't. But Jesus knew what it was. Because we're told that when he tasted it, he refused to accept it. That verb they gave to Jesus is repeated. And I can't quite work out whether Jesus was given this before he was nailed to the cross, as he was getting nailed to the cross, or repeatedly as he was on the cross. And this is the first of two drinks that Jesus was offered. So the image that we have is of the second one, where they put a sponge in vinegar, put it on a hyssop branch, and gave it to him. And Jesus drank that. But he didn't drink this. Why? Well, we'll talk about the reasons why he drank the second drink later on, but I think there's a really good reason why he didn't want to drink a narcotic. And I suspect that when we put together Mark chapter 10 and John chapter 18, where Jesus says, "Are you able to drink of the cup that I am to drink with?" And James and John in Mark 10 say, "Yeah, sure, we can do that." Peter then lops off Malchus' servant's ear. Jesus heals him and says again, "Are you able to drink of this cup?" So it was, I suppose in a sense, it was almost like he was cheating the experience if he used some type of sedative, mild or otherwise. But I think really what he needed and what he wanted was a clear mind. Now, let's put ourselves in Jesus' situation. Our body would have been screaming for anything to relieve the pain, for any way to get out of the situation. We would have taken water, vinegar, as Jesus did later, anything as a relief. So even though his body was urging him to do this, he resisted. And he did fully drink of the cup that his father had given him right to the bitter end. Now, when we left this story in Mark 15 a couple of years ago, we finished sort of at this idea of Mark's record and Luke's record, and I'm pretty sure, yeah, Luke chapter 9 and Mark chapter 8, where Jesus announced this radical new manifesto, which was to deny ourselves and to follow him. So I'll ask the same questions now as I did back then. If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves, take up their cross every day and follow me. So how's that going? How's our time with Jesus? How is our listening to God? How is our talking to God? How is our praise and worship of God? In what sense have we denied ourselves yesterday, or today, tomorrow, or the next decade? How precisely have I bent down, steadied myself, and heaved a heavy piece of timber on my back? Yesterday, today, tomorrow, and so on. So a couple of points here. It's not a team event, this manifesto. And actually, it doesn't matter if we didn't pick up the cross last week or yesterday. What matters is picking up the cross, denying ourselves today, and that we are still doing our best to follow tomorrow. To follow. Now, I think if I ask the question, in the wild, if we think about wildlife and animals, what animal comes to mind when we say the word follow? So I guess the first thing that came to my mind was ants. You know, you see these ants going one after the other. And then I thought about the wildebeests in the Serengeti, that they're all sort of following each other madly, dancing upon the heads of crocodiles to jump across the river, scale up the steep bank and avoid getting eaten to get onto the green pastures. But of course, the number one animal that we know as a follower on the count of three, one, two, three, is a?
Lemming.
A bird, yes. Yes, yes. What bird? A goose?
No, they migrate.
They do migrate. Yeah. Actually, their patterns are pretty cool. So that was the first thing that came to your head there, Hughie?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. It's okay. In John chapter 10, Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. And the background to this story is referencing words in Ezekiel where the priests and the leaders were just gorging themselves selfishly without a care for their people who were neglected, exposed and vulnerable. So John says, or records, I assure you, he who does not enter by the door into the sheepfold but climbs up from some other place, that one is a thief and a robber. So it's a question that leaders need to ask from time to time. Are we leading appropriately? Now, what does it say thief and a robber? What doesn't just say thief or purloiner or robber? Well, there's obviously two different ideas, right? So the idea of a thief. A thief is like, it's almost like an artist, you know, someone that can, a bit like MacGyver, you know, with an old Wrigley's chewy wrapper, can like break into these complicated safes, something like that. It's amazing what you could do with one of those old spearmint Wrigley's chewy wrappers. Now, some thieves steal everything that isn't nailed down. But this thief is so good, so crafty, that he would steal the nails as well, maybe even our fingernails. So this is the guy that goes into the motel and doesn't just nick the little coffee satchels and the tea and the shampoo and, you know, the body wash. If the TV's not nailed down, that's going in the suitcase as well. But that is different to the robber. The robber is the guy in the balaclava who does this activity by violence. Not necessarily by need, but almost by this fetish or this desire for control, and likes to spend the money. So Isaiah then talks about Jesus and the type of leader he is. He will feed his flock. He will gather his lambs in his arms and carry them and gently lead those that are with young. Well, we've read about someone tonight who is described as a robber. And his name was Barabbas. Now, Barabbas receives the ultimate get-out-of-jail-free card. So he had a rap sheet that was as long as your left arm. He was a robber, he was a notorious insurrectionist, he was a murderer. And he also has this rarefied honour of being named personally in all four Gospels. And there's probably a reason for that. Now remember, it's his cross. There are three crucifixions that are going to happen on Passover Day. Two of his accomplices and him, Barabbas, is the leader. So before they go to the crucifixion, they are in their cells, the Praetorian Guard, a couple of hundred of them, get this big stone, they tie them up to the stone and beat the living daylights out of them with their whips. And in their whips they have bits of teeth and bone and iron and all sorts. But their cell, just imagine that Sunday school room, right? That there's no beds, there's no toilet, there's 30 criminals in here that are all waiting for justice. That includes Jesus. So, there's a knock at the door. Barabbas! So Barabbas has to steel himself because he knows that his flogging is about to come. So the old rusty gate gets opened up. They roughly grab a hold of Barabbas. He's steeling himself for the final round of abuse. And, well, somehow he's freed. I'd imagine he's like standing at the gate going, what's going on? Barabbas is freed. So Pilate says, I want to release someone. You know, Barabbas. And in the John record, it says, I'll give you a choice. You can have Barabbas or you can have this Jesus who you call the king. You can have Barabbas or this Jesus. See, Barabbas had a Christian name and it was Jesus. Barabbas. Bar means a son of. Abba means father. Or sometimes it's called rabbi. So what is this telling us about this guy here? Well, he's the son of a father. Well, that includes everyone, right? That's all of us. Well, he's the son of a rabbi, which has this focus on the law. And so the Jews are saying, well, we want to release Barabbas because we want the law. You can take the son of God. We'll take the son of everyone. And there we have this contrast between law and grace. Barabbas, the notorious prisoner, represented everything that was bad. Jesus, on the other hand, represented everything that was good. So a little speculation warning here. You know, don't groan, I haven't given it to you yet. Right. I can't imagine that when Barabbas is released, he quietly and thankfully tiptoes away. But I can imagine him going back to his life of crime. So what happens when he's freed? I could just imagine him as, you know, the soldiers are in the Praetorian and so see you later, Barabbas. I could just imagine Barabbas as somebody says, I'm out of here. See you later. And with his own colourful language, out he goes. He's pumping his fists. He's getting pats on the back from his henchmen. He goes to the Jerusalem post office to buy himself a lotto ticket and he heads back to his underground lair, which is known as his underground lair. Quick lesson. We have been set free from the bondage of sin and we know that old temptations just don't disappear. Those temptations are the cross our daily cross that Jesus is telling us we need to carry for him every day. So you can see how the insurrectionist would return to his life of crime, right? We can see that, but that's just a guess. He could have gone back to the old life of purloining, insurrecting and soldiering. Probably did. Or maybe he didn't. Think of how many people in the Gospels are mentioned by name in all of them. It's really few. So it's almost as though the writers are all saying, well, you obviously know Barabbas. Oh, yeah, that's right, Barabbas. Yeah, he was the Jesus whose cross that Jesus ended up being crucified on. The other Jesus. Yes, he might have been infamous and that's why he was recognised. Or perhaps, like Simon the Cyrenian, like Rufus and Alexander, like their mother, like Pontius Pilate's wife, like the Roman centurion, like the soldiers, like the other malefactor, maybe, just maybe, Barabbas, the other Jesus, turned the corner. I don't think it's beyond belief at all to imagine Barabbas listening as Jesus was getting beaten up, saying nothing, when him and his mates were getting towed up, cursing, swearing, beside themselves. Jesus, as quiet as a lamb, just accepting it. And then realising that he gets the get out of jail free card, but it's his cross that Jesus has to carry and be crucified on. And he then goes out to Golgotha himself, hiding in the crowd amongst that big group of followers, and sees Jesus up there dying for him on his cross. Is it far more likely he returns to the life of crime and dies in a ditch or becomes a brother? Just remember, he, like everyone else, felt the earthquake. He would have seen the sky darken. He would have heard stories about graves being opened. He would have heard stories about the veil being rent in two. Well, that cross had his name on it and it was replaced at the last minute. Not by the son of the rabbi, but by the king of the Jews. I think it's entirely plausible that his name is there because he was known by the first century brothers and sisters. Now, I don't have the Jerusalem Ecclesia's membership role, so I can't be for certain. I can't say that he was a baptized member, but I'd like to think that if he showed up at a meeting to hear the apostles' teaching, fellowship, breaking of bread, prayers, that Barabbas would have been welcomed. I'd like to think that a robber, a rioter, a violent insurrectionist, bandit, sinner has a place in our ecclesias too. After all, we're all the sons of our fathers who have become the sons of the Father. So whatever happened to Barabbas, can't confidently say, but I can say what happened for him. Jesus died in his place. And I can say with complete confidence that Jesus would and has taken my place on that cross, not as a substitute, but because he was wounded for my sins, for my crimes, for my insurrections, for my murders, for my robberies, for my thieving, for my adulteries, for my lusts, for my slanders, for my gossip. It was my sin that held Jesus there. But for Barabbas, where we read in Isaiah, he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, there was a physical reality to that. Barabbas' grief and sorrow was the cross, and Jesus physically carried Barabbas' cross. So, Jesus literally carried Barabbas' sorrow until, of course, he couldn't carry it anymore. We won't talk about Simon the Cyrenian. I will just have a look at, just as we finish, Tweez. We're going to talk about Tweez just for a moment. I'm not sure if anyone's been to a rainforest or if anyone's been north of the Daintree River. But in tropical rainforests, the height of some of these trees is astounding, and they're all clustered so close together. It's incredible. North of the Daintree is very prone to cyclones. In fact, it's really hard to get a loan north of the Daintree. If you're a mortgage insurer, you don't even insure properties up there, so you can never borrow much more than 70% of the property's valuation if you can find a bank to help you. Why? Because the risk is that your house will be blown to Timbuktu. Not so the trees. The trees will bend. Occasionally there'll be a lost limb. The trees will be shredded, like if you've been through Bingle Bay where the Olivers and Franklins are, like we have after the cyclone, like the whole place is denuded. Like there is, it's like Hiroshima. It's like a nuclear bomb's gone through the place. So it's amazing with their massive canopies, their strong stems, that they bend and they don't get blown over. Well, we know the reason why they don't get blown over. It's because they are grounded. So, Anna and I, we power walked up a hill. Yes, Anna was so far into the distance, I was striding after her. So on this walk, Bicton Hill, I stopped off at a couple of points and I was, you know, doing my best I was doing my best horticultural lesson. And one of the things that I do remember showing Anna was the pathway sort of gets cut because whilst there's heaps and heaps of rain, often there's soil erosion, right? And it's often the soil erosion which causes the trees to topple over because their roots haven't got anything to hold on to. But one of the amazing things about these root systems in the tropics are root systems called buttress roots. So if you go into the zoo and you park sort of behind the botanic gardens, well, you know there's the park there, there's a few olives, and there's some massive Moreton Bay figs. Well, those roots, you can see some of them are this high. They're really complicated, thin. They're buttress roots. And they're deep, they're deep, they're deep, they're deep. They're not deep at all, but they are wide. But in a forest, it's like they talk to each other. The roots sort of interlock and they make the whole thing really strong. So, God willing, what we'd like to talk about in the next fortnight when we meet are some of these principles that I will call Jesus' groundedness, some of these ideas that helped him get through the most difficult event imaginable. Thanks, Ted.